Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Harris, Judge Cochran, Judge Riley, the Honorable Jepal Harris presiding.
Please be seated.
Good morning, counsel. We have two cases on the calendar for today. In a moment, I am going to begin calling cases. When I call your case, you each will have 15 minutes for your argument. Appellant, you will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. On the podium, on the left-hand side, there's a button that raises and lowers it so that you can raise it to your preferred height. This is being recorded, so I ask that when you do start each part of your argument, please note your name for the record. And with that, we are now calling court files A240648, A240675, Nicole Hansen, petitioner respondent, versus Jay Hansen, appellate. The appellant can begin your argument when you are ready.
May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Kenneth White, and I'm an attorney from Mankato, Minnesota, fighting a Minnesota cold. This case raises issues before you, brought by appellant Jay Hansen, whom I represent, in basically four major categories. I'd like to focus my time, subject of course to this court's questions, on two of those. Those two being the tracing issue and the home sale proceeds issues. There are also issues related to the Rule 60.02 motion that was brought and the motion for amended findings versus motion for reconsideration. I think those issues have been adequately briefed, and unless this court has specific questions, figuring I'm going to run out of time anyway, I will. I'd like to focus on the two primary merits issues, if you will, as opposed to the procedural issues. The tracing issue is one that I think where the district court headed off in the wrong direction early on, and unfortunately stayed in the wrong direction. The issue here before this court is whether the referee, as then confirmed by the district court, applied the appropriate legal standard, and thus this court is undertaking de novo review. The referee and the respondent, wife in response, rely on three primary issues as arguing that the commingling of funds resulted in situation where the tracing undertaken by husband was insufficient. Strikingly, though, neither the district court nor the respondent make any argument that the tracing was not accurate. That is, that there is some step in that process, that accounting process, that was lost.
Well, counsel, one question I do have is, in looking at the district court orders, as it relates to the various sections, the wife's IRA, as well as the contra fund, the court does make a number of credibility determinations and particularly finds husband's testimony not credible in those areas. How should this court look at those credibility findings as it relates to whether or not the court believed the actual method in which the appellant undertook in trying to trace those funds?
Your Honor, the problem, I think, is multiple fold here. In the first place, the credibility determinations are as to husband's testimony. They are not as to the documentation. And if you look at...
Well, wasn't part of the issue that there wasn't... The husband didn't submit all of the documentation that, in hindsight, he would have liked to have submitted.
Well, that is in relation to the house sale proceeds, not the tracing. So we need to keep those very distinct.
But, counsel, as it relates to that tracing document, husband did submit the exhibit, and the husband testified as it relates to that exhibit, and particularly rather than testify at length, I think the husband took kind of a portion and said, this is how you should look at this document. If the court then took all of the testimony of the husband, including the testimony around that document, and said, quite frankly, this court doesn't believe you or there's a credibility issue. Again, is it an error of the court to disregard that testimony, or did the district court disregard that testimony by making that finding that the husband was not credible?
I think, Your Honor, the problem, again, is that, again, it's twofold. One, the court is, district court is applying the wrong law, and that's where I was headed. But number two, in making the factual finding, what the district, the district court also found husband's testimony credible in certain other areas. So it's not as if the district court simply said, husband, you're lying to me beginning to end, and I'm not going to believe anything you're going to say. But the tracing issue is one where the documentation was complete. All of the accounts were there, and there was no dispute about what happened to the money. There was no argument that the money went from the inheritance, the $400,000+, into a joint checking or joint savings account. From there, some of it went into a municipal bond fund, Fidelity Municipal Fund, and from there into the contra fund, and some monies went directly from the savings account to the contra fund. None of that was disputed by anyone. Wife agreed to it, husband agreed to it, post-trial motions set it forth, final arguments set it forth.
Maybe this goes to your legal argument, but I think that the district court also made findings that husband treated those investments as joint investments.
Yes, Your Honor.
And specifically found that the investments had joint rights of survivorship, and that husband looked into investments that would benefit would maximize retirement benefits for both parties. That's finding 104. So given that, how did the district court err in its analysis or its conclusion that those assets were marital assets and not non-marital assets?
And there, Your Honor, is the legal argument. That's the legal error here. The referee and the wife rely on three things in finding that the funds were commingled and thus became marital. First, the change in title, that the funds were put into an account that was titled in both names. This court has repeatedly, and as best I can tell, universally held that a change in title does not eliminate the possibility of tracing. And you've done it both ways. You've done it in terms of money going from an individual into a joint account, but you also, in the Fleiderer case, did the reverse, where money was spent as a tax saving vehicle, or where funds were deposited as a tax saving vehicle from a joint account into an individual account. And this court said, no, that does not eliminate the possibilities of tracing. You still just go through the basic accounting analysis.
Can you point us to a case where that involved a joint rights to survivorship?
I can't think of one off the top of my head, Your Honor, but virtually every account that anyone sets up in joint name has a joint, if it's not a house or something. But even if it's there are a number of cases where money goes into a house, and I think Griffith is one. There, again, rights of survivorship exist under our estate planning statutes. The wife, the surviving spouse gets the house. So that, again, is not a dispositive factor that this court has looked to in any of its prior precedent. The second thing that the district court and the respondent rely upon is the time. Time has never been an issue that this court has considered, and you've looked at all kinds of cases where an asset has been traced that has been in a particular location for a lengthy period of time. And the third issue, and I think this somewhat goes to your initial question, Judge, is this issue of intent. What was the intent of the parties when they set up, when they moved the money? Or the intent of one of the parties when they move the money. But this court has never held intent to be a factor. And in fact, in Griffith, the district court did exactly that, said the parties intended to make this marital funds. And this court said, no, that's not material to the determination, and reversed that decision and said, no, it is not marital funds. They are non-marital. They maintain their non-marital character. And that makes sense, both in terms of the legislative construct of and concept of commingling under the statute, and also keeping the distinction between a gift and a change in title of ownership of assets under our statutes.
So I have a question, just a practical question to understand the remedy that you are seeking. And I'm looking at page 25 of your brief, and you say you acknowledge that any reinvested shares from dividends or interest which occurred during the marriage are marital. Those assets, therefore, are not or were not at issue. It was simply the initial investments and the asset valuation gains over the year. So your client received, let's just call it $457,000. $13,000 went to each of the Roth IRAs, and so there, and then $350,000 went to the Fidelity Minnesota Municipal Fund, and eventually to the Contra Fund. So just tell me how you, what you practically, the arithmetic. Of what
the arithmetic, I think, Your Honor, is relatively simple. There's 400, to use your number, there's $450,000 worth of inheritance money that my client received. That is ultimately invested in largely two places, the Roth IRAs and the Contra Fund. That money, that principal, and whatever number of shares it bought, and I'm afraid I don't remember that number, whatever number of shares of the Contra Fund or the equivalent investments in the Roth IRAs, that would be the non-marital share. And then any investment income, which would be passive income from those, which would then maintain its non-marital characteristic. Any investment income that resulted in increased shares, those shares would be marital. And so it's a matter of arithmetic, but that the district court would have to undertake. But it is done in the motion for amended findings in kind of excruciating detail by trial counsel. And so if this court wants to walk through the arithmetic, it's available. It just is, it gets a little complicated because of all the places the money is going and the way it needs to be transferred. So I would submit to this court that the only issue in a tracing dispute is whether one can start with an initial pot of money and trace it to an asset, follow it through to the asset. If that is accomplished, absent a gift, the tracing is successful and the asset maintains its non-marital character. And if we start getting into title differences and intent issues and all the rest, we throw a huge monkey wrench into the way that dissolution matters have been tried and resolved in this case in this state for decades, where tracing is treated as an largely arithmetic accounting kind of process where you march through trying to determine whether or not you can find the funds here and here and here and whether the documentation supports that. And a district court makes that determination. But here there's no factual dispute about it. Nobody claimed that the tracing itself was inaccurate. And the $10,000 in round numbers that was initially in the joint savings account can only get spent once. And there are multiple places where those funds might have been used, and the district court, in its discretion, for example, could determine that that $10,000 was used to purchase wife's Roth IRA. That would then maintain its marital character. Or and 4,000 of husband's Roth IRA. And so that would maintain its non or its marital character. But the remaining balance, all the money that ended up in the contra fund, the money that went into the vehicles, all of that is now lost. Or is only non-marital money. There simply isn't enough money around to accomplish all those other purposes. And so it's not a gift. The tracing is completed, and the district court simply erred as a matter of law in finding that tracing was insufficient. In terms of the house sale, I think the critical issue here is it was never an issue between the parties. Both parties agreed that the bank accounts of each other accounted for the $180,000 or so worth of house sale proceeds. And the district court or the referee, in rather sharp language, said, I'm not going to create evidence or make a finding without basis. That's simply inaccurate because the factual basis was there. It simply required a reasonable inference, and that's all that the referee needed to undertake. And the referee didn't even consider whether that reasonable inference could be made. And so there is error there that this court should reverse and remand. My time is up, so unless there are further questions, I'll wait for my rebuttal period.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Thomas Braun, B-R-A-U-N. I'm an attorney at Rustovich Braun & Associates from Rochester, Minnesota. I acted as trial counsel for wife in this case, in this four-day trial, which took place in Olmsted County, and assisted the court in providing proposed findings and have reviewed extensively this 49-page opinion from the court, which goes through in really painstaking fashion, analyzing the evidence and the facts of this case. And the court makes significant credibility determinations in that opinion. The issue as it relates to the tracing is really one of a question of fact, and that's supported by Kerr versus Kerr. And for this court
turning to that issue then, I think Mr. White stated that nobody claimed the tracing was inaccurate. Do you agree with that?
I do not agree with that. And certainly the court didn't agree with that. And there was extensive testimony related to this issue. So when husband testified about his intent and when he placed the money into a joint account, I asked him at trial, why didn't you place that money into an account with just your name on it if you wanted to keep it separate, if you didn't want to commingle those funds? And his answer was, that's a good question, and offered no additional testimony. And if you look at all of the transactions
in terms
as a whole,
of the chart that shows the tracing of the funds, anyone dispute the accuracy of that chart?
So the accuracy of the chart, I don't believe was really an issue. It was that the funds were commingled as soon as they were placed into that account because there was $10,000 of marital money there.
But commingling by itself doesn't make them marital funds. Would you agree with that?
The commingling itself, well, it depends on the tracing, right? And if the district court, can validate the tracing or not. And the court, in this case, very clearly stated that the monies were commingled. That's a question of fact, and it's a question of credibility. And to disturb questions of credibility requires a clearly erroneous standard of review. And, the father attempted to persuade the district court that those credibility determinations were not appropriate on a motion for amended findings, which the court, in short order, took significant issue with. When you read the opinion as a whole, the court really found that father or husband lacked credibility with what he was attempting to do in terms of this tracing. Because not only was it the contra fund and the Minnesota Municipal Fund, he tried to back out the purchase of a vehicle. He tried to back out his decision to place money in my client's IRA, which was solely in her name. And I think that the court's determination that the investment vehicle that the parties jointly chose, so this was a determination about how to invest this money that was made by both of them. And there's significant testimony to support that. And the fact that the investment vehicle really was, an asset which had joint rights of survivorship, I think was significant to the court, because at that point she had a vested interest in those monies that he then claimed were solely his. So when the dissolution started, you know, he then began this, and I think the court used this language, this retroactive rehawk construction of what his intent was, what his decisions were, when clearly the decisions were joint decisions that are being made based on what the parties construed as their money. And the court makes factual findings which supports that, and that's consistent with the testimony, really, of both parties. His attempt to prove the non-marital claim simply failed. And, you know, I do a lot of trial work, and frankly, when we have these type of non-marital claims, generally there's an expert which comes in, an accountant, to provide a tracing. His tracing was simply, you know, a spreadsheet that he created with then kind of this, you know, adopted mentality that, you know, that inheritance was his and not theirs. And clearly that was not the decisions that were being made at the time. That wasn't his intent, and that's not where the money ultimately went. So the district court, I think, you know, saw that and made those credibility determinations. And I think really, at the end of the day, issued a pretty scathing opinion with respect to what he was attempting to do by asserting these non-marital claims. And the district court really didn't hold back in that regard in terms of what it believed him to be purporting to say and what the facts actually supported. The appellant had brought a motion for amended findings and a motion for a new trial based on this house issue, right? So the parties had sold the marital home, split the proceeds, and then came to trial with respect to unsettled property distribution, all right? There was no stipulations, there was no agreements, and husband, admitted bank records to support his proposed asset distribution. He omitted records that he then attempted to admit at the motion for amended findings or open the record for a new trial, which the court denied. There's a finding in the motion for amended findings, I think, that is really significant for this court to review. The district court found that it was intentional that he didn't submit the bank records that he was then attempting to put in as a result of his motion for a new trial. That credibility determination, I think, is significant. I mean, this was a four-day case with probably, you know, 200 exhibits. So, you know, the court goes through the Findon factors in pretty significant and painstaking fashion in that motion for amended findings. And on each factor, apart from factor four, the court found that the appellant, father, petitioner, did not meet the Findon factors, and all four Findon factors have to be met in order to reopen the case or to support a motion for a new trial. So the factual determinations that are underlying that denial of appellant's motion, I think, are significant, and the court should give deference to those. This district court.
So, in terms of the Findon factors, though, do you think the court properly analyzed all four of them, or do you think maybe on the first Findon factor, the court didn't actually deal with whether there was a meritorious claim, debatably meritorious claim?
I think that the court adequately addressed each factor. I think that factors two and three, the court certainly found did not support a new trial. And again, all four factors have to be met. So I think that the court, in looking at whether a new trial was appropriate, made those factual determinations. And this court, given the fact that that referee sat for a four-day trial with these parties, should give deference to those findings.
So with regard to the second Findon factor, did the court, you think it was fair of the court to say that husband himself should have provided documentation as opposed to the attorney? It seems to me that that's what the court is kind of concluding.
Well, I think that it's, you know, looking at his case as a whole, because there were voluminous submissions with respect to financial documents in this case. So if he was, you know, purporting that that money should be attributed to him based on the sale of that home, that should have been included on at least an asset liability sheet at a minimum, let alone the bank records which would support that affirmation. And the district court basically said that it's not going to manufacture or generate evidence on behalf of the petitioner. So I think that, you know, the court was mindful of that determination when the court denied that motion for a new trial. And I think that, you know, the credibility, again, of father, husband, is a significant issue. And the court making that determination that he intentionally omitted those records, you know, is significant. And again, that credibility determination, you know, should not be disturbed unless the court finds that it was clearly erroneous. And frankly, I don't even think appellant is suggesting that. So that's all I have for you, unless you have any more additional questions for me at this time.
I do have one question. So, counsel, if this court found that the district court did err in the tracing issue, is that dispositive to the motion for amended finding and subsequent conduct-based attorney's fees? That being, if we found that the court did err on the tracing issue, does that also decide those other two issues?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I mean, I think that the attorney's fees issue really stems from the lack of legitimacy of the motion for amended findings. You know,
if this court found that the district court erred in the tracing issue, and from my reading, a great large bulk of the motion for amended findings go to that issue of tracing, then isn't this court, I guess, implicitly finding that, you know, there was a basis for the motion for amended finding, and if there's a basis for the motion for amended finding, does that eliminate the basis for this court or for that court to impose conduct-based attorney's fees?
So when arguing a motion for amended findings, typically the proponent of the motion has to articulate why the court erred, what the error was, and how to correct it. Essentially here, the appellant took the same position that he took at trial, basically reasserting the proposed findings that he had already submitted again. So, you know, a motion for amended findings is not a motion for reconsideration. A motion for reconsideration, you have to ask permission to the district court to make that motion, and then if granted, articulate the reason for the request for reconsideration, which is essentially what the motion for amended finding was in this case. There wasn't a new position articulated or something articulated to the judge that wasn't already argued. So I respectfully, I guess, disagree with the assertion that the motion for amended findings, attorney's fees, should just trail off of, you know, what the court decides with respect to the tracing issue.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Let me quickly address a handful of issues that came up during respondent's argument. First, I think it is massively significant that counsel acknowledged that the tracing chart is accurate. There is no dispute about where the money went. There never has been a dispute about where the money went. Everyone agrees where the money went. How the district court then dealt with that chart in making a legal determination about whether what factors to consider and what issues to consider in making a determination of whether the tracing was sufficient is the issue before this court. On remand, the district court can go back and fix the tracing problem and come up with the correct answer. There was a question from the panel about a case involving joint survivorship provisions, and again, there's nothing in the Griffith decision that sets that out. But if you look at the Griffith decision, which is cited extensively in our memorandum, that's money that went into a joint checking account. I don't know of a joint checking account you can create which doesn't have joint rights of survivorship, because you can both sign on the bottom line and the bank will cash your checks. So I think this court has never looked at survivorship as a significant distinguishing issue. I'm a little concerned that counsel seems to be trying to argue that the gift was a joint gift from the estate to his client and my client. I don't think there was any testimony to support that, and I don't think even wife argued that at the trial court level. There's no question it was a gift to husband individually. The issue was, what did he do with the money? Lastly, let me briefly address the attorney's fees issue and how I think that fits into this puzzle, if you will. The district court granted attorney's fees because it found that the motion for amended findings was not a motion for amended findings. It was a motion for reconsideration. The motion for amended findings in Minnesota has two primary hallmarks. One is that you are bound by the record that exists at the end of the trial. You can't add new evidence. And two is that it is your obligation as an attorney to argue where the district court erred so that the district court can reconsider its discretion. Well, where does the district court apply its discretion in making factual findings and credibility determinations and all of those kinds of things? So by its very nature, a motion for amended findings takes the existing record and says, Judge, I think you committed this error. But this particular motion for amended findings went even farther and said, Judge, you not only committed these discretionary errors, but you applied the wrong law. Let's fix the legal analysis so that we don't have that issue as well, and you can actually apply your discretion under the context of the appropriate law. And so that is the context in which this motion for amended findings was raised. And if this court finds it to have been proper, everyone agrees in their brief and before the district court that the award of attorney's fees is improper and should be stricken. So as a procedural matter, if this court finds it is a motion for amended findings, then the attorney's fees falls. Compare a motion for amended findings to a motion for reconsideration. What does the comment tell us about what a motion for reconsideration is intended to be? It's intended for those circumstances where there is a clear and obvious error, an arithmetic kind of error. Everyone understands that you're dealing with a $100,000 account and the judge puts $10,000 in. There's a typo and you need to add the zero. That's one motion for reconsideration. The other is where the law has changed in the interim. So there is a binding decision from an appellate court that changes the law that the district court applied and thus the decision that the district court reached. Those are the two settings for motions for reconsideration that the comments to the rule suggest and where most practitioners go. Absent this kind of distinction, you put practitioners in an impossible setting given that a motion for reconsideration does not extend the time for appeal. A motion for amended findings does, and a district court can effectively cut off the right to appeal by finding that a motion for amended findings is a motion for reconsideration and the 60 days has long passed. So we would ask that the court strike the attorney's fees and grant remand as prayed for in the conclusion of the brief. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments as well as your briefing. This matter is submitted and we will issue an opinion within the statutory time frame. Thank you both. Thank you.